Global reaction to San Bernardino today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Authorities say they don't know what the motive was for the mass shooting in San Bernardino. People at the mosque where one of the suspects prayed are both shocked and worried.
Shocked because they know this man, and they said they had no idea that he was capable of this. Worried because now they're fearful of a possible violence against the mosque.
The shooting in California is reverberating in South Africa, a country that's used to gun violence, but not mass shootings.
And that is something that South Africans find quite alien and quite worrying.
Plus, our reporter in Paris worries about all the guns back here in her second home of America.
I don't know that I would feel more safe there because of the guns.
That's all ahead today on The World. We don't know. That's the answer officials have been giving all day when asked why a husband and wife opened fire on a holiday party yesterday in San Bernardino, California. 14 people have been confirmed dead in the attack, more than 20 injured. The suspects, 28-year-old Syed Rizwan Farouk and 27-year-old Tashfeen Malik, were shot and killed by police in a fierce gun battle in the streets of San Bernardino. President Obama today said it's too early to tell what their motives may have been.
It is possible that this was terrorist-related, but we don't know. It's also possible that this was workplace-related.
We're going to spend a lot of time on The World today getting perspectives on the shooting from outside the U.S. But first, let's get the perspective from inside. Earlier today, I spoke with KCRW's Saul Gonzalez. He had just been at the mosque in San Bernardino, where Farouk used to worship.
San Bernardino is a very, very poor community. And this mosque is in a very, very poor neighborhood of San Bernardino. What I saw there were parishioners just starting to gather for prayers later in the day. They were all men in this case, and they were shocked and worried. Shocked because they know this man, and they said they had no idea that he was capable of this. Worried because now they're fearful of a possible violence against the mosque. They were talking, well, should we station people outside while everybody's inside praying just in case there is violence? So they're thinking about the man they prayed with who committed this, reportedly, you know, committed this horrible act, and also what they're going to do to protect themselves.
Yeah, and I imagine the news was still very fresh for them, and they were in a kind of trying to process it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're trying to think about if there were any signs in Mr. Farouk's behavior that they should have been aware of. They know a lot more about him than his wife. He said he was a religious man. He would come to mosque regularly, but not all the time. They told me that the couple got married in Mecca as a sign of their religious faith. But there was nothing unusual about this man. And from what they knew about his wife, nothing about her that was unusual, that raised any alarm bells.
Let's step back a bit, Saul, and talk about this area. I've heard San Bernardino called the Detroit of Southern California. You just said it's one of the poorest places in the state. How does that all kind of fit into Southern California?
Well, you know, we often, I think a lot of people think of California as having a north-south divide, San Francisco versus Los Angeles. But really what it is, it's an east-west divide where you have a far more prosperous coastal area. And then inland California struggles. It struggles with unemployment, with higher crime. It's still struggling with the collapse of the housing market. And San Bernardino is one of these ground zeros for a lot of these problems. I mean, about 50% of the residents here are on some sort of public assistance, according to the census in 2010, the second poorest big city in the United States. But it's also a place where new immigrants can find a foothold in the United States and start getting their piece of the American dream or the California dream. It's a place where if you're new to this country, you can afford an apartment, you can afford a place to maybe buy a home, where you couldn't do that in Orange County or L.A. or San Diego.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Funnily enough, we spoke with an animator yesterday who grew up in San Bernardino. His father was from India. It's got a booming immigrant population, but are these immigrants working their way up the ladder of prosperity in San Bernardino is one rung, or are they stalled out in San Bernardino?
I think they're trying to work their way out. You know, you compare this to, you know, other cities in the United States that have had problems, Detroit or Akron. Those communities, they've had a decline in population, though. San Bernardino's population is twice what it was 20 years ago. So despite its problems, you have people coming in, a lot of them immigrants. They start businesses here. you know, it's an interesting alchemy here in the community of problems, but also opportunity, particularly for newcomers. I mean, just one story. In recent months, you had Guatemala open their second consulate in California here in San Bernardino. It's an acknowledgement of the growing Central American community. You also get a lot of people from Muslim countries. It's a surprisingly large and vibrant Muslim community here in Southern California. And you've had problems. You had some tensions here in this part of California between kind of an older white Anglo population. There have been tensions over the construction of a mosque about 20 to 30 miles south of the shooting incident a couple of years back.
Now, Saul, you grew up around San Bernardino. Tell me one thing about the city that you think really speaks volumes about it.
You know what it does? You know, you come through and it reminds you of kind of another place in America. Even as a native Southern California, it can feel at times like a place apart, and it has more in common with a Detroit or rural Arkansas or Mississippi than surrounding communities. That's what really strikes you about this place. I mean, driving here today to this parking lot where I'm talking to you, you know, you pass these road signs of 1960s America. You know, you pass these old bowling alleys and coffee shops that are so Route 66. And next to them, you have the halal shop and you have the carniceria. And it's just this real interesting juxtaposition that really you see here in a way that you don't see in a lot of other places, even in a very multicultural California.
KCRW's Saul Gonzalez speaking with me earlier from San Bernardino. Let's turn now to Angela Cachurga. She's a journalist based in El Paso, Texas, and has covered the border between the U.S. and Mexico for two decades. That means she's seen a lot of gun violence, much of it involving drug cartels. And the weapon of choice among drug traffickers is the same one that caused so much carnage yesterday, assault rifles.
Yeah, they're very, very popular. AR-15s, AK-47s, which is known in Mexico as the Cuerno de Chivo, the goat's horn because of the shape of the magazine. There are multiple sources. Mexico has some of the strictest gun control laws in the world, but yet cartels have easy access. In some cases, they're able to get the weapons. They come through the U.S., often bought in border states and smuggled across the border piecemeal. And also they're smuggled across the Central American border into Mexico and from other countries. So really from Mexico's both borders, the cartels were able to bring in weapons.
So tell me more about Mexico's laws regarding guns, if they've got some of the toughest gun control laws in the world.
They really do. I mean, unlike the U.S. where you can go down to your local gun store or a gun show and buy a weapon, in Mexico there's only one store. It's run by the military. It's based in Mexico City, the capital, and it's very, very tough to get a weapon. So most people do not go to that store. And obviously people involved in illegal activity are looking elsewhere on the black market to buy their weapons.
So one legal store to buy guns in all of Mexico.
Yes, run by the military and very, very tough to qualify to get a weapon.
And yet the availability of guns in Mexico is pretty wide. That's what you're saying.
Readily available. I mean, I've covered a lot of the drug violence along the border in Mexico, and clearly there's no shortage of weapons. I mean, in Ciudad Juarez, where we had multiple mass murders during the peak drug war years, fortunately things have gotten better, but during those peak years, we saw lots of mass murders and primarily gun violence. I mean, that was the way hitmen were running around killing people en masse. I mean, in public places, birthday parties, malls. And so that is something that was a very painful part of Mexico's reality during that drug war in Juarez.
So work this out for us. What is the connection between the availability of guns in Mexico and U.S. gun laws, specifically California's assault weapons ban?
Well, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, it's a ban in California, but clearly the weapons were brought across the state lines. I mean, you have a similar situation along the border. You have the U.S. trying to do more of the so-called southbound or outbound searches, looking for weapons and bulk cash, but people are able to get around. They can smuggle between the ports of entry. They can look where there aren't U.S. authorities doing these periodic checks. They're smuggled. Often you see, you know, the drugs coming in concealed cars and hidden compartments, and going south, you see weapons and cash. So there are the same methods used to take weapons out of the country and guns into Mexico. They're used to bring drugs across the border into the U.S.
Journalist Angela Cachurga there in El Paso. Let's check in now with France, where gun violence is still heavy on people's minds. Paris still coming to terms with the deadly attacks that happened almost 3 weeks ago. Adeline Sia is a reporter and friend of the show. She divides her time between the U.S. and France.
You know, since the attacks in Paris, I have a lot of friends and family in the U.S. who have called me and checked in on me and said, you know, what are you doing? Are you saved? Are you thinking of returning to the U.S.? You know, has this changed any of your plans to be in France for a while? And I tell them, if you ask me the same question when I'm in Cambridge, back home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live, I don't know that I would feel more safe there because of the guns.
You're also a parent, Adele, and when we've got violent events in our midst, I'm just wondering if you can tell me what it's been like parenting in the States versus parenting in France. Are you less worried about your kids in French schools?
Well, I mean, you're asking this question just a couple of weeks after the worst attack in France in decades since World War II. But I'm really more, I mean, when I was, my kids were going to school in Cambridge, I was more concerned sometimes just in the morning. I was not concerned about bombs there. I was concerned about their day being safe from, a guy walking in with a gun bought at Walmart in a different state, perhaps. I mean, Massachusetts has stricter gun laws than anywhere else. But it was in the back of my mind, especially after the Newtown shootings in Connecticut. I mean, it's just something that you feel you have very little control over. Now that we're in France, I am less concerned about random shootings. I'm concerned about terrorism. I would say selfishly that we also live in a small town where I don't feel like there would be a lot of terrorists would not be really interested in attacking. But, you know, no one's really safe from it. So I don't really have concerns here of that nature. I probably have others, but I don't have, you know, I have concern about the severity of the French school system, for example. But I don't really have concerns about the random gun shootings. No, not on a daily basis, that's for sure.
Severity of the school system as in being very strict.
Yes.
When you think, Adele, about returning to the U.S., and I don't know if you are, but when you think about that versus staying in France and you think about violence and guns, how much a consideration is all that and how do you weigh it?
Well, my considerations for being in France or in the U.S. are not really based on violence, on where it's more violent. I am really hurt when there is an attack in the U.S. I'm hurt when there's an attack here in France. I guess it's a different kind of fright, right? I mean, you think about terrorism as, you know, people plotting in the dark. There's something incredibly menacing about it. Whereas, you know, with the shooting San Bernardino, you feel that it's more just a random thing, the kind that happens all the time. But I, you know, that makes me hurt too, because it's still happening. You know, it's just hard to tell yourself that it seems like it would not be such a complicated issue to resolve compared to the one of terrorism, which is huge and global.
Adeline Spear speaking with me from her home in France. Thank you very much, Adele.
You're welcome, Marco.
Coming up later on The World, more international reaction to the shooting in California. We'll head to South Africa and get the view from there. Stick with us here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Just a few hours after Britain decided to join the coalition against ISIS, British jets were flying over Syria, bombing targets on the ground. Earlier this week, Germany was debating whether it should join the anti-ISIS coalition. We often turn to Joshua Landis when we want to talk about Syria. He's a longtime Syria watcher at the University of Oklahoma. I asked him how things are going to change now that Britain has joined the fight.
Well, Europe is looking for unity. After the French bombing, everybody is trying to get on board, and they understand that the refugee outflow from Syria imperils all of their political systems and is increasing the popularity of right parties in Europe. And so I think there is a real sense of urgency. The question, though, is what do you do after the bombing? Who are you going to replace ISIS with? Because Insurgency 101 would suggest that the only way to defeat an insurgency like ISIS is to provide a better government for the people down below. And that's the problem that nobody has answered.
But in the short term, don't you need to defeat ISIS?
Well, you can't defeat ISIS without replacing them on the ground, because you can bomb them, you can kill their people, but they're showing an incredible ability to recruit new recruits. And as long as there's no one who's going to push them out on the ground, it's going to be hard. You can keep them weak. You can keep them on their heels, but you can't defeat them.
If the shootings and bombings in Paris had not happened, do you think the UK would have joined the coalition? Do you think Germany would be thinking about it?
Everybody was thinking we can contain ISIS. And the president, President Obama, had said that we had contained ISIS. So there was a sense that ISIS was more interested in building a state in Syria and Iraq than it was in trying to bomb Paris or the United States, and that therefore it was not really a threat to our national security. Paris changed that thinking completely.
Well, we saw the problems of deconflicting the skies over Syria with Turkey shooting down at that Russian jet. Is a bigger coalition necessarily a better coalition?
Well, if they agree on how to settle the Syrian civil war, it's a better coalition. But as long as there's deep distrust and differences over can Assad be a part of a new Syria? Do you have a ceasefire and divide Syria like a Yugoslavia where you have a Sunni rebel side and you have a Assad ruled side and a Kurdish side? Or do you want one group to win the whole thing and keep Syria united? Those are the questions that nobody has answered.
Maybe a coalition is not the way to go. Let me just quote this tweet that somebody posted yesterday. There is one rule in war, do what your enemy least wants you to do, but it seems the coalition partners are about to do what ISIS most wants them to do. Do you believe that rule is applicable in the case of ISIS?
Clearly, ISIS wants to fight Americans on the ground. Now, we have denied them troops on the ground and are just bombing them, which is weakening them terribly. But increasingly, we're sending special forces. So it's unclear. We don't want to get drawn into a long war. On the other hand, we have to defeat this menace because Paris underlines why we have to do that. And so that's the conundrum.
You know, Joshua, one thing that came up in the debate in the British Parliament yesterday was the notion that bombing ISIS might increase the risk of attacks on British soil. How much do leaders in the UK and Germany really worry about that?
Well, they have to worry about it. And we've seen other people be reluctant to get into Syria because they don't want to get tangled into this revenge cycle of revenge. And that is a problem. On the other hand, you cannot be intimidated by these people because if you don't, if you just try to hold back and not get in, you're never going to defeat them. And I think ultimately what's going to come out of the Paris bombing is that Europe and European governments are going to spend a lot more money on intelligence. And they're going to give up a lot of their civil, you know, their political freedoms the way Americans have.
Joshua Landis there discussing the coalition against ISIS. From ISIS, let's turn to another extremist group, the Taliban. Karachi is Pakistan's largest city. It used to be relatively free of Taliban influence. But in the last 2 years, Taliban networks have moved into the city, forcing out existing organized crime groups. My BBC colleague Mobeen Ajar just spent several weeks embedded with Karachi's anti-Taliban police unit. He told me that the Taliban's preferred tactic is kidnapping.
Karachi, over the past few years, has seen a rise in kidnappings, but traditionally, it had been something that gangs would do. So gangs would kidnap people and then extort money. What we've seen in the last couple of years is the movement of the Taliban from the north of Pakistan into big cities like Lahore and more so Karachi. And the Taliban has effectively taken over from gangs and top sliced these gangs, which means now they're using kidnap as a tactic of war and a tactic of terror. So it's a really scary time to live in Karachi.
All right. So given that, tell us about being embedded with one of the police units that's specifically tasked with targeting the Taliban in Karachi. What is the work like for those officers?
I was embedded with a particular unit that has become known as the Taliban Hunters. I spent about 3 weeks with them. This unit is led by a guy called Specialist Superintendent Ijaz. And I spent some time with him whilst they were preparing to go on an anti-kidnap raid. Now, in the safety briefing just before we left on this raid, we were told that we were going into an area of Karachi that was known as a Taliban stronghold. And we went on this raid. And I think what you're about to hear is the moment before Officer Ijaz gives the signal to knock on the door of this house, which is where two suspected Taliban members are hiding out. The suspects open fire.
As soon as we got in there, there was the sound of a kind of an alarm. And a few of the officers told me, that these Taliban members sound the alarm to tell people in the area that the police are here. That's why we have to make a quick exit right now. We have to get out of the area.
Officer Ijaz explained to me that in rare cases, there can be an instance where an arrest might be made and then the local Taliban supporters will sound an alarm. And what that indicates to anyone supporting the Taliban in that area is that it's a call to arms. So it's a way of saying to them, you should flood this area. The police is here and we need to attack them. Now, it was really quite scary because on the given night, as soon as there was a gun battle, we could hear this alarm. If you can imagine, it's a really quiet area. So the only thing you can hear were our footsteps and a few dogs barking in the distance. All of a sudden, after the gun battle, it was as if someone was standing up somewhere high on a rooftop and banging these two metal bars together. The sound kind of ricocheted around the whole area. And at that point, the police took the two suspects and they just said to me, Officer Ijaz said, we need to get out of here right now. They're going to flood the area and they will kill us.
So after what you saw, Mobeen, are raids like the one we heard making a dent in Taliban crime in Karachi?
I would say they are. I mean, it's been really difficult to get up-to-date figures. And, you know, if you look at things like the rate and the number of police being killed in Karachi by members of the Taliban, that has gone down significantly in the past year. But realistically, adequate figures aren't available at this stage. And more so, what we can really see is that the rate of conviction is tiny. So far this year, if you look at terrorism cases, conviction rates are about 6%. So I think most people would acknowledge that they're pretty terrible figures.
My colleague, the BBC's Mobeen Ajar there. Mobeen's reporting was also featured in a recent PBS Frontline called The Taliban Hunters. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, a veteran of failed climate summits of the past, thinks Paris will be different.
So I think we will have an agreement. And I think by 2030, we will have a whole different world.
Plus, South Africans know gun violence, but what do they make of America's mass shootings? That's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We continue to follow the Global Climate Summit in Paris. The prevailing moods flip between frustration and optimism. Frustration because countries remain fundamentally at odds, even despite dire warnings of the catastrophe should this summit fail to produce a deal. Optimism because these nations are still talking, and also perhaps because of those dire warnings of catastrophe. There is hope for a deal even among people who've witnessed the excruciatingly slow pace of previous climate talks. Paul Brown is a former environment reporter for The Guardian who's covered just about every climate summit since the first one in Rio de Janeiro back in 1992. This time around, Brown says, things definitely feel different.
I'm an optimist. Despite years of having the sand thrown in my eyes, if you like, but I do think there is a change of mood. Honestly, I don't think it's politically possible now for any country to prevent progress, and people really want to get on with this thing. So I think we will have an agreement where you can ratchet up the targets at 5-year intervals, and I think by 2030 we will have a whole different world.
Getting to that point, though, will continue to be a long, hard slog. One issue right now, for example, is aid from rich countries to poor ones to help deal with the worst effects of climate change. Gambia's environment minister said flat out today that if the issue isn't adequately addressed, there will be, quote, no agreement in Paris. But his French counterpart said that failure at the talks is unthinkable. Brown expects to hear more rhetoric like this.
There's a huge gap between the understanding of Europe and North America and the rest of the planet. I mean, even now, if you go to India, they hardly know anything about climate change, and they're much more interested in development. And the world just doesn't see things through the same set of glasses. I mean, when I went to Rio, I was astonished at the attitude of some of the developing world countries, because I came to it from a European perspective. And you have here an astonishing 196 nations talking to each other. It's no wonder that misunderstandings arise.
And don't go away. Brown says that's just one reason progress has been slow. Another, he says, is homegrown, right here in the United States.
Without criticizing your great country, I think the Republican Party has been one of the single biggest stumbling blocks to progress in this area. I was astonished when I first came to these climate talks to find the fossil fuel lobby from America dominating the proceedings. And they're still trying very hard to throw obstructions in the way of the climate talks. So there are vested interests, and of course the oil states of the Middle East are also among the people who have tried to stop progress at every possible juncture.
But Brown thinks these forces are losing steam and being replaced by people and businesses with different values.
If you come to Europe now and you see all the renewables, the houses covered in solar panels and so on, the speed with which renewables have been adopted in Europe in the last 5 years is clearly staggering. And China and lots of other big industrial countries see renewables as the future.
Paul Brown, an environment reporter now with the Climate News Network. He was speaking with me from the floor of the Paris Climate Summit. Brown may be optimistic about a deal being reached, but he's not so optimistic about the state of the planet as the effects of climate change start to set in. Among those effects, weather extremes. We're seeing that in India right now. The heaviest rainfall in more than 100 years is ravaging parts of southern India. More than 13 inches of rain fell in the city of Chennai in just 24 hours. Much of that city is underwater now, and thousands have been forced to flee from their homes. Extreme weather events like these grab the headlines, but just as devastating to people's lives are other less dramatic changes in climate. The World's Sam Eaton has a story of a place, also in India, where rising sea levels are threatening to wipe out millions of people's homes.
Shonaban Bibi is a 45-year-old single mother. She lives in a tiny riverside shack in the Sundarbans, a vast network of coastal islands spanning the border between India and Bangladesh. Bibi's only income is from rolling bidis, the local cigarettes, a status that ranks her among India's poorest. She says sometimes she and her 12-year-old daughter only eat one meal a day, sometimes nothing at all. And she says every year she faces more problems. The water keeps flooding her home here in the village of Dokhali, keeping her from work and forcing repairs she can't afford. Bibi says she already fled the area once after losing everything to a cyclone, but an illness sent her home after 3 years working in a factory. Now she worries she'll have to leave again once the rapidly eroding land under her home is gone for good, which may not be that far off.
Average sea level rise in this part of the world is double the average sea level rise in the rest part of the world. This is number one.
Asish Ghosh is an ecologist from Kolkata who's been working in the Sundarbans for decades.
Average sea surface temperature rise is significantly higher than the rest of the world. So these two combinations is making that 4.5 million people who are living in India and Sundarban one of the most vulnerable people in the entire global scenario.
It's a complex problem. Water is not only rising, the land here is also sinking. At the tip of Sagar Island, about 100 miles away from Bibi's home, on the Bay of Bengal, that vulnerability Ghosh speaks of is all too stark.
The land is eroded, and when the high tide comes up, it comes up to here.
He points inland, or what used to be inland, to where the tide has surged more than 100 yards past the eroded earthen dike we're standing on, past several abandoned and badly damaged homes, and into rice fields now flooded with seawater. Ghosh says tens of thousands of people have already been driven from this landscape, a slow drip exodus that's about to become a full-blown crisis.
Between 2030, and 2050, we have to move more than 1 million people from this island area of Sundarban to the mainland area. And are we ready for that?
The answer, according to Anurag Danda of WWF India, is a resounding no. Donda says unlike cyclones that displace thousands of people at a time, these localized, gradual changes go largely unnoticed by governments and international aid groups.
Unfortunately, the recognition of this environmental change is just not there.
But a recent report prepared for the UN says when you add up the mounting losses from climate change, it's these small-scale disasters that are taking the biggest toll on the world's poorest people. And here in the Sundarbans, Donda says government inaction leaves most of these environmental migrants and the towns they flee to fend for themselves.
The small towns within the Sundarbans are growing at such a rapid pace that they're being overwhelmed in terms of capacities to deal with that kind of population.
Donda says the region could face instability and conflict as the flood of migrants grows, not to mention the influx from the even more populated islands just across the border in Bangladesh. It's a fear shared by Asish Ghosh.
As a scientist of 50 years' experience, I don't think that I can assure anyone, don't be worried, everything is all right. No, it's not going to be all right.
But Ghosh says it doesn't have to be hopeless. Instead of leaving the migrants to their own fate, Ghosh envisions a massive retraining program to transform the Sundarbans' unskilled farmers and fishers into a new workforce for India's surging economy.
We need carpenter, we need electrician, we need plumber, crane operators.
Recasting migration as an opportunity for a better life rather than a measure of desperation. A means of hope in a region where hope is hard to come by. But for now, that opportunity remains just a hope for people like Uttam Deloy. He knows what it means to be displaced by rising seas. He's already moved once to Sagar Island from nearby Goramara Island. Deloy says the land he and his family left behind is gone. But he's one of the lucky ones. Deloy came to Sagar under a government resettlement program that no longer exists. But he says his new life now feels equally perilous. Deloy says he's heard that Sagar will suffer the same fate as the island he left behind, which is now half underwater. Three other islands in the Indian Sundarbans have already disappeared entirely, and he fears his new home could soon follow. For The World, I'm Sam Eaton, Sagar Island, India.
Follow the Sign. The Sign is a new track from Ghanaian reggae musician Rocky Daouni. Rocky will be in Paris next week for the ongoing climate change summit. The sign Rocky follows when he's not making music is smoke coming out of a wood fire. In his native Ghana, as in many parts of the world, a kitchen consists of three stones with a wood or charcoal fire below, on top, a pot to cook in. But here's the thing about that setup. The carbon in the smoke aggravates climate change and is dangerous to human health. These are problems that Rocky Daouni has gotten deeply involved with solving. Rocky often goes back to Ghana to help his people build better cook stoves, ones that don't use so much wood and pollute cities and villages. And he'll be promoting the cook stoves in Paris. But before leaving, Rocky Daouni stopped by the World Studios to talk about what he saw on a recent trip home to Ghana.
Every day you see this situation. Now, when you go to your traditional homes, you know, the women go to gather firewood. They come home to cook for their families. And then you see smoke billowing and people coughing and all that kind of stuff. And then the kids in the kitchen. And then we all shrug it off at something that is no big deal, you know. But once I started being aware of the impact of that, you know, 4.3 million people globally dying from smoke-related issue.
Wow, is that the number? 4.3 million?
Yeah, 4.3 million globally. You
per
know.
Per year? Or
per year, yes.
Wow.
Yes, yes.
From
yes.
respiratory diseases related to
Yeah, related to, yeah, smoke. Cook stoves and then, you know, so how we call it household air pollution, you know. Hearing this, every Ghanaian knows, you know, a sister or a relative, you know, who cooks this way. We all need to cook to live. Cooking is a joyful thing. But if there is a certain cost to it, people all of a sudden are beginning to wake up. And then also understanding that, you know, all this, the charcoal and the wood that we're cutting is totally depleting, you know, our forest. Ghana's, you know, forest is pretty much, I mean, I think about 80% of our original forest is gone right now. You know, and then the model of also scaling it up to and make it financially viable to attract new investors, you know, and new entrepreneurs from the bottom of the pyramid. And so I feel wholesomely it's a great idea.
Rocky, you live in Los Angeles, right? That's your home these days.
Yes.
And I know California's got its own environmental issues, but this must be an issue that really kind of strikes you really deeply, I imagine, when you're in Los Angeles and you turn on your stove and you get natural gas or an electric coil, that allows you to cook. And I have no idea where your own mind goes in those moments. Like, are you thinking about Ghana and how actually kind of hard it is to make food?
Well, the thing is that sometimes, you know, those subtle privileges of really being able to go and then turn on, you know, our stoves here, you cook, it's clean. It's only when you're doing your barbecue that you inhale right. a little bit of smoke, you know. And granted, in Ghana, there are, you know, a good number of people who have LPG gas and all that. So, you know, you have, you know, it's aspirational. But the greater number of people don't have that access. Although I will be in Los Angeles and turn on my gas, at the same time, I feel that every clean cooking opportunity I have, that means that I got to keep amplifying my voice to make sure that the 3 billion people out there to have access to clean cooking solutions.
Maybe all of this suggests that, you know, the kind of political wrangling over temperature degree rise that is permissible, 2 degrees Celsius, 1.5 degrees Celsius, what should it be? That perhaps the best things people are doing as activists to fight climate change are these little projects like the one you're involved in with improved cook stoves.
Is there
something there you think that maybe we should be paying more attention to?
You know, I think that every big idea, a lot of times we think the big solutions are usually the right solutions. But I feel that when you're able to make an activist of everybody, when individuals adopt it and become also contributors to it, then you have a mass movement going. And so I feel that cooking every day, it's part of being human. And if people understand that the act of cooking, through the act of cooking and the usage of a clean medium of cooking can be able to, will give them their ability to vote as and contribute individually to stemming climate change. And that's why I feel that being on the ground and also spurring, being a catalyst on the ground for it, and at the same time, too, being part of the bigger conversation, too, and spurring the leadership to action, too, is the way to go. Everybody is part of the solution.
Singer Rocky Dawuni from Ghana telling me about what he's doing to stem climate change and try to make lives better in one corner of the world. Here's a song from his just-released album that he suggested we play. It's called Children of Abraham.
Children of Abraham, will you put your weapons down? Children, lay your weapons down. Children of Abraham, will you put your weapons down?
From Rocky Dawuni's latest CD, Branches of the Same Tree, that's Children of Abraham. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Back to our top story now today, the mass shooting in San Bernardino. The tragic events in California are making headlines across the globe, including in South Africa, a country that sees its own fair share of gun violence. In fact, South Africans are paying close attention to the latest twist in the case of Oscar Pistorius. The Olympic blade runner had been convicted of manslaughter in the shooting death of his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp. But now an appeals court in South Africa has overturned that conviction and announced that Pistorius murdered Steenkamp. It means that he could spend more time in jail than originally thought. I've got South African journalist Kim Klute on the line from Cape Town to discuss both Pistorius and events in California. Kim, let's start with Oscar Pistorius.
Well, there's generally been quite a positive reaction. They're very, very pleased that Oscar Pistorius has lost his appeal. I think people saw it coming, but not quite as strongly. And there was a full bench of appeal judges who ruled. And I think that many people are very, very happy about it. As you know, crime is extremely high in South Africa, and especially against women. And that has sent out a very, very strong message that no matter who you are, you're not going to get away with it. So I think now finally the family feel very much, you know, that Reva has got justice. And in fact, Reva's mother said sort of respect for Reva and respect for women in South Africa. They think they've definitely done the right thing.
Now, yesterday in the U.S., as you know, San Bernardino, California, a mass shooting, more than a dozen people killed. Just give us a context in South Africa for this kind of gun violence.
For sure. South Africans are quite shocked by mass shootings like that. You know, they're very, very familiar with crime. We live with it every day. We've got a huge problem, a huge gun culture problem here as well. But mass shootings are something quite alien to South Africans. There's certain number of family murders. There's some murders around witchcraft, which involves, you know, 2-3 people, but nothing like the mass shootings that you have in the US and the fear that invokes.
Yeah, so when the San Bernardino shooting happened yesterday, I mean, how do South Africans typically react? They say, well, that's what you get when you have a country with a lot of guns, or they say that would never happen here.
There's quite a lot of shock about it. There's always talk on social media about the mass shootings, especially when that map came out on the number of mass shootings throughout the U.S., that really provoked a lot of comments. And so every time there's a mass shooting, it certainly stirs up a lot of emotions in South Africa. But I think they've almost become used to it, which is sort of a worry. You know, they think, well, that's the US kind of problem. We've got our own problems here. But I think something that's sort of sparked a lot of debate is the worry that there could be terrorism involved. I think that's where South Africans feel they could relate, because we've obviously had our own terrorism mainly in North Africa and in Kenya. So people wonder or worry that it'll come down. But as far as mass shootings and that you have at schools and such in San Bernardino, we don't have that here.
Yeah, we're still waiting to see just how strong the links are to terrorism in the San Bernardino case. In South Africa, how easy is it to get guns?
Well, you're supposed to have a license. I mean, you do have to have a license. So there is a certain amount of gun control, but there is a lot of illegal weapons that are floating around. So it's better than it was before. After apartheid, there was an enormous amount of illegal weapons that were circulating. And South Africa has the second highest number of gun-related deaths in the world. So we don't have nearly as many guns per capita in the US, but we have almost as many gun-related deaths. So there's a lot of people just shooting at random and shooting, you know, to kill in South Africa.
Have you ever had any close calls with gun violence yourself?
I had most recently had a housebreaking, and I do believe they had guns, but we fortunately were sleeping when they came in. That was only about 10 days ago, and they kind of cleaned us out of house and cars. But close calls with a knife, yes, I have, not with guns.
Have you ever contemplated defending yourself?
I have. I've taken a self-defense course. That's about as far as I would go, but I wouldn't carry a gun. Although I know many South Africans, many people even in my neighborhood would beg to differ with me. I know they sleep, some people sleep with a gun next to, you know, under their bed or in their car. It's just not the kind of thing that I would do, but they've certainly seen a rise in that. Because, yes, it's very easy to get hold of a gun in South Africa.
So you would say that most South Africans would agree there are too many guns in South Africa and something needs to be done about it?
Yeah, definitely, especially in certain areas that are so badly hit by gangsters. Gangsterism is huge, especially in the outskirts of Cape Town. Children, yesterday there was a four-year-old who was shot in the crossfire. It just happens all the time. So it's starting to really affect communities. It affects people across the board. And there's this very strong feeling that this has to stop.
And finally, do South Africans see the United States as a dangerous place?
No, I don't think as dangerous as South Africa. I think there's a worry about terrorism, especially, you know, since the World Trade Center. But I don't think they see it as a dangerous place. I think they see it as, you know, far better off than South Africa, simply because people here are affected by crime, not by mass shootings, but by crime, you know, almost on a daily basis. It's very top of mind for South Africa, the high crime rate. And I think they almost see the U.S. as a great break. People love to go there to get away from the violence.
It's all relative. Kim Kluti, journalist in Cape Town, South Africa. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's finish today's show with something upbeat, or Afrobeat to be precise. The sound known as Afrobeat comes from Nigeria. The truth is, though, lots of people play Afrobeat these days, not just Nigerians. For example, these guys. This is Bishiga 70. To find their musical inspiration, we head due north out of Cape Town fly over Namibia and land in Angola. Pick up some musical vibes there and then turn left, crossing the Atlantic to Sao Paulo, Brazil. That's where the 10 members of Bixiga 70 live. And what I just described kind of sums up their music. Big elements of Afrobeat, combined with sounds from the former Portuguese colony of Angola and the wild modern artifacts they fold in from Sao Paulo. This is one of the most fun CDs I've heard this year. In the coming weeks, we'll be bringing you more music that brought us some joy in 2015, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, remember Bixiga 70. Here's more of their track, Martelo, the Hammer. I don't know about you, but that gets my blood racing. Great new sounds from Brazil's Bixiga 70. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Thank you for being with us this Thursday. Hope you can be back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.